This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, June 16th. I'm Matt Martin. Coming up, 20,000 undocumented workers rally in Los Angeles to support the AFL-CIO's plan to grant them amnesty. Protesters face off with Big Oil in Calgary. The African National Congress, once banned and exiled for fighting apartheid, is kicking out one of its own members for opposing privatization. And death row inmate and journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal addresses graduating seniors at a New York high school. The AFL-CIO kicked off a campaign to defend undocumented workers this week. A crowd of close to 20,000 jammed the L.A. Coliseum as the Labor Federation held the last and largest of a series of forums to promote its new immigration policy. Unions have called for a general amnesty for undocumented workers and their families. Robin Yurovich reports from Los Angeles.
A ver ese grito! ¡Sí se puede!
Most of the overflow crowd were immigrants from Mexico and Central America. But there were also Asian, European, and Caribbean workers who waved American flags along with standards of their own countries as the County Federation of Labor's Miguel Contreras welcomed them.
I see thousands of you holding up the American flags. Raise them up, levanta las banderas, to show this country that we belong, to show America that we belong.
It was a massive outpouring of support for the AFL-CIO's plan to defend immigrant workers. Current U.S. immigration policy, which makes it a crime to hire undocumented workers, has been supported by the Labor Federation since 1985. But according to AFL-CIO Executive Vice President Linda Chavez-Thompson, unions now believe the policy is a failure.
We have to replace it with new enforcement against those employers who violate the rights of any worker in America, documented or undocumented. It's time to offer amnesty to all undocumented workers and their families who have been working hard and giving so much for so long to their communities.
Workers testified on stage as union presidents and a handful of elected officials took note. 17-year-old Carmen Colleen said she'd been working in the agricultural fields of California since she was 10. But without legal documents, she can't get a driver's license or study at a public college.
De verdad, les digo con el corazón en la mano que quiero salir adelante. Y hay veces
Colleen
que
says, I want to get ahead, but I get depressed because I don't have a green card and I know that I can't go to college. Please, I ask for unconditional amnesty, she said. And Maria Sanchez told of how she and her co-workers at a Palm Springs hotel were fired when they demanded better pay and benefits. When they were finally ordered reinstated, the company demanded proof of their legal status. They all refused and won their jobs back. But Sanchez says she learned how employers use immigration law to break unions.
Hemos aprendido que el jefe utilizará siempre inmigración contra nosotros cuando no nos pueda vencer de otra manera.
We've learned, she says, that the bosses will always use immigration against us if they can't win any other way. Under amnesty, workers would have respect. And we have to take away the employer's right to hide behind immigration law anytime he wants to attack the union. The choice of Los Angeles for this final forum is significant. There are more undocumented immigrants here than in any other city, and some of the most successful immigrant worker organizing in recent years has happened here. That's caught the attention of union leadership, who are increasingly focused on organizing new workers, says Kent Wong, who directs the UCLA Labor Center.
The move to organize immigrant workers forced the issue on the American labor movement. How could they, on the one hand, welcome with open arms this new generation of immigrant workers into their unions, while at the same time claiming to uphold a policy which really enhances their exploitation and abuse, which is employer sanctions?
Hotel and Restaurant Workers Union local president Maria Elena Durazo says a proposal like amnesty would have been unthinkable just 20 years ago when she started organizing. But unions, she says, have faced demographic and economic realities. The workforce is changing, and the wage gap between rich and poor is growing. And unions need as many workers as possible to fight back.
Immigrants are not just in a few cities. If you look through the Midwest, if you look in the South, there are whole towns where immigrants have now either Asian immigrants, Vietnamese, Latino immigrants. Immigrants are everywhere. And so you have to face that reality. If we're going to be a labor movement of all workers, then we have to face a brand new demographic reality and a new reality that the capitalism in this country does not, you know, is the greediest we've ever seen it and doesn't share in even the most reasonable way.
Labor Federation leaders say they'll outline the details of their amnesty proposal in a white paper due out in August. The proposals are likely to run into stiff opposition in Congress and from groups that seek to limit immigration. There's also a debate about how much the unions should compromise with business groups who want to bring high-tech and agricultural workers into the country on restrictive visas. Union activists say those proposals are reminiscent of the 1950s Bracero program, where workers could be thrown out of the country for demanding wages due them or for joining a union. Meantime, unions, particularly in Southern California, plan to mobilize workers at the ballot box and in the streets to build support for amnesty. And they say a new wave of immigrant organizing is also likely in the works. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Robin Yurovich in Los Angeles.
Secretary of Energy Bill Richardson has again come under fire for lapses in security at the Los Alamos National Laboratory, with reports that two computer drives containing information on defusing nuclear weapons have gone missing since early May. Security at the lab has drawn congressional attention since March of 1999, when reports first surfaced about Dr. Wen-Ho Lee, a nuclear scientist at Los Alamos suspected of spying for China. I spoke to Diane Chin, executive director of the San Francisco-based civil rights group Chinese for Affirmative Action. Chin has been active in the Coalition Against Racial and Ethnic Scapegoating, which has criticized Lee's prosecution. I asked her how the recent revelations at Los Alamos reflected on Wen-Ho Lee's case.
Well, I think that this latest fiasco at Los Alamos really does just point to or underscore arguments that we in the coalition and other activists have been making all along, which is that clearly there have been serious security lapses at Los Alamos, and that when these first came out, and Secretary Richardson ran the risk of having egg on his face, is really when they started looking for a scapegoat, and we believe that scapegoat is Wen-Ho Lee. Even after all of the alleged reforms that they've made and new efforts that they have said that they've undertaken over the last 6 months to ensure that security is tighter, they can have a lapse like this. And I just think it points to the utter incompetence of the government. And again, points out that the case that they've brought against Dr. Lee is almost farcical.
You and other defenders of Dr. Lee have said that he's been the victim of racial profiling. Do you think the Energy Department continues to display a pattern of differential treatment based on race?
Well, as you know, there have been reports, discrimination complaints filed against various laboratories. I actually met with some scientists from Los Alamos a couple of months ago who were very concerned about Department of Energy policies that are being developed, which they believe could have a disparate impact on individuals, especially who were not born in the United States. A majority of the scientists who are in the labs who are immigrants are Asian scientists, and they're very concerned that some of these new policies, which require reporting of contacts with foreign nationals, require fairly extensive scrutiny if individuals travel out of the country to what are considered sensitive foreign countries, et cetera, will land at the feet of these Asian scientists in a way that could jeopardize either their own job security, their security clearances, or their ability to be placed on the kinds of projects that they think that they deserve.
Los Alamos is obviously under unprecedented scrutiny right now, particularly from Congress. How do you think that that's affected the way that Wen-Ho Lee has been treated?
Unfortunately, I don't think it's affected it at all. The man is still incarcerated. He's still in solitary confinement. He's still in shackles. His visitation rights are still very limited. We would have hoped that by now the administration would look at this situation, see the problems that are inherent in the case that has been brought against Dr. Lee, and look at it within the context of everything else that has gone on at Los Alamos. The change that we think should have occurred is that this man should at least be released on bail, if not having all of the charges against him dropped at this point.
Diane Chin is executive director of Chinese for Affirmative Action. Wen Ho Lee's trial is scheduled to begin in November. The World Petroleum Congress met this week in Calgary, Alberta, and was expected to be the focus of demonstrations similar to those against the World Trade Organization in Seattle. Thousands of protesters did make their way into the streets, but despite high security around delegates and a massive deployment of police in riot gear, there were few confrontations. But as Cameron Bond reports from radio station CJSW in Calgary, the protesters did get across their message about the environmental and human rights impacts of big oil.
Teach-ins, workshops, and actions were conducted throughout Calgary. Last Sunday, about 2,000 people staged a peaceful family-oriented march and rallied through downtown Calgary. And during the week, smaller groups have been staging street theater, information pickets, and other peaceful protests near the conference or in front of our numerous oil buildings.
The genocide of Indigenous people, environmental degradation, and climate change are not acceptable byproducts of the oil industry. We want to see a change to appropriate energy sources, and we want to see democracy and justice now.
I spoke with Courtney Kirk, one of the organizers for the End of Oil Action Coalition, on Monday morning.
Do you think this message is getting across well? Or?
I think it is. I think that we're having a nonviolent, peaceful protest, which was the intention from the very beginning. We're here raising our voices in our democratic right to do so, and I'm really looking forward to how the day unfolds.
Along with these actions, members of the Edmonton chapter of the Sierra Club staged a teach-in, which hosted a wide variety of speakers from around Canada and the world. One speaker was Project Underground's Danny Kennedy, who spoke mainly on Chevron's recent use of Nigerian soldiers to kill activists and the plight of the UWA in Colombia, but also explained how oil and gas has led to human rights abuses throughout the world.
And you can name any one of the major companies, you know, call out a name, Mobil. I'll tell you about Aceh, where these boys have been burying bodies, digging mass graves with their bulldozers for the Indonesian government to kill separatists in Aceh for a decade. Business Week reported on that 2 years ago. We've got, you know, Shell in Nigeria. I've got affidavits on file in my office that show sworn affidavits from the key witnesses for the prosecution of Owens's brother that they lied and were bribed to do so by Shell executives. I've got munitions requisition on Shell letterhead for the forces that went into the Ogoni country and killed 2,000 people between 1994 and 1996. They paid field allowances to those soldiers. You know, you can talk about Unocal in Burma that is using forced labor in order to build a goddamn pipeline to ship gas out of Burma into Thailand for electrification of that country. Any one of these companies has blood on its hands, and that is the business of pumping and producing oil in this day and age.
Another speaker was Alex Boston of the Vancouver-based David Suzuki Foundation, who discussed the health effects and the economic effects of our dependency on oil.
There's a couple of really critical health concerns to consider. Firstly, whenever we burn fossil fuel, you produce common air pollutants. Carbon monoxide, nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxide, particulate matter, volatile organic compounds. These air pollutants are responsible for killing prematurely 16,000 Canadians every year. That's 40 Canadians essentially a day. That's four Walkertons. It's a jumbo jet falling out of the sky every week. One thing that's happening because of climate change is that the more hot summer days you have, these common air pollutants are forming more frequently into ground-level ozone, or smog. Smog is already a serious issue in this country. It's estimated to cost Canadians in their pockets and our healthcare system $10 billion a year. Smog is unsafe at any level of exposure. With a doubling of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we're going to see smog levels increase by 5 times.
Along with these issues were concerns over British Petroleum's involvement in Tibet and the recent construction of an oil drilling station in the Arctic, which stands to reduce polar bear habitat and damage one of the Earth's most fragile ecosystems, as well the role of oil and gas firms in affecting government environmental policy and scientific studies, and the lack of investment in alternative sources of fuel was also questioned. Speaking with some oil and gas workers, they feel that the industry recognizes these problems and is actually trying to address them. With billions of dollars at stake, it is hard to say what will happen from the actions of this conference. Most people I spoke with feel that the actions have been a success, and the peaceful nature of the protests allowed for a greater exposure of the issues as the media, which predicted mass rioting and looting, had little more to report on. In Calgary, Alberta, Canada, this is Cameron Bond.
An audit commissioned by the California State Legislature says the Pacifica Foundation, the country's premier progressive radio network, violated its mission and possibly broke the law. Aaron Glantz has more from Sacramento.
The committee report says Pacifica may have committed illegal acts leading up to, during, and following last summer's lockout at its Berkeley station, KPFA. Among them, violating the foundation's democratic rules of governance and its contract with the Communication Workers of America, Local 9415. The report also says Pacifica Foundation's use of listener donations for armed guards and public relations firms was, quote, inconsistent with established practices and inconsistent with reasonable donor expectations. California State Assemblywoman Dion Ariner requested the audit. This was her reaction to the report from the State Legislative Audit Committee.
It's not like you can go and report this to your local police department. The question one, from my perspective, is really what the public's perception and the public as a listener, and whether or not they have the confidence in the management of this station and in Pacifica Foundation to continue to make the kinds of financial contributions that they do.
The audit comes as a freelance reporter strike against Pacifica enters its fifth month. The reporters say Pacifica is censoring legitimate news stories. In the last 2 weeks, two more stations, WCBN in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and KBOO in Portland, Oregon, have announced they're dropping Pacifica programming in response to the crisis, bringing the total number of stations canceling Pacifica to four. At its board meeting in Washington last weekend, Pacifica tabled a proposal to mediate the crisis without a vote. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Sacramento.
As a movement against white minority rule in South Africa, the African National Congress brought together a wide range of political sensibilities. Since taking power in 1994, however, differences over economic policy have strained the anti-apartheid coalition. Most recently, Trevor Ngawe, who represents the Kumvu section of Soweto on the Johannesburg Metropolitan Council, was kicked out of the party for his opposition to Egoli 2002, a plan in Johannesburg to privatize everything from the healthcare system to the city zoo. Ngawe described the scope of the plan to Free Speech Radio News correspondent Naeem Jinnah.
Already we've heard that the Johannesburg City Library has stopped buying new books. If you go there now, there's a big box outside. Please donate old magazines, because they are not buying new books, because, you know, there is no money. With, for example, things like electricity, like water, as soon as electricity is no longer regarded as a service to the community, as a basic necessity, and regarded as a commodity, as something to be bought and sold, what is going to happen? There will be an increase in the price of electricity. Secondly, it's already happening in Soweto. There's been a spate of electricity power cut-offs for those citizens who are behind in their electricity payments. Now, one can say, and I do agree, people must pay for their services. But in a place like Soweto, you'll find that it's documented more than 50% are unemployed. And of those who do work, less than a quarter actually get a living wage. But with this new commercial outlook, you know, if you can't afford to pay for electricity, you won't get it. If you can't afford water, you won't get it. So this is where we're standing now. Yeah.
Trevor, you've outlined for us, a very brief kind of outline, what Egoli 2002 is all about. What's the process where it is at the moment? How far has it gone? What would be achieved by 2002 in terms of the council?
They've already sold off Metro Gas for a song, £10 million. And in fact, its true value is more like £50 million. They have already sold off the Rand Airport, again for a song. They have already sold off the Metro Center, where the council conducts its affairs. They've sold it off and are now leasing it back. So now what we're doing is we're paying rent, you know, in our own building.
Trevor, if all goes according to plan, in terms of the plan that the council has, by 2002, what would they be doing? Councillors, I mean.
Councillors will meet once a year, look at the different companies who have put in their tenders, award those tenders, and then they go home and do nothing, basically. Yeah.
So why should I even vote for you? I mean, from the perspective of an ordinary citizen, why the hell should I even vote in this election coming up in November if the people that I'm electing all the reason that I'm voting for them, they're giving it away or they're selling it off to private companies. Why would I ever in future bother about voting in a municipal election?
Naheem, I think you got a very good point there. If you look at countries like the USA, the number of people who go and vote is very low. Hmm. Sometimes it's as low as 30%. That's because people know that their vote does not mean much. Hmm. As you know, in the USA, if you want to be president, you must have $10 million, etc., etc. And then they run their local government along the same lines.
Hmm.
So citizens get apathetic. And here in South Africa, within 6-7 years of our democracy, our young democracy, you know, our famous democracy, we'll see people, voting with
the Because, I mean, the whole issue of our struggle wasn't just a struggle against racism, but it was a struggle for control of our lives. Come, as you say, 6 years after our first election, we've come to a point where we're saying that what we would rather do is give all lots of this kind of power over our lives to people who are completely unelected.
Yes, you're right. And in any case, any attack on democracy in South Africa, with its history of inequality, its history of colonialism, of apartheid, is a direct attack on our struggle for social and economic justice. The people of South Africa, the ordinary people, the previously disadvantaged, the poor, you know, blacks.
It sounds so obvious and so simple that any dumb person can understand that this is a bad thing. I'm sure your fellow councillors are little better than just dumb.
You know, one can say it's the ANC position. Let's say it's the official position really branches were never consulted.
Mm.
You know, we councillors were not consulted. We were told this is the plan which is going to work now. You know, go and tell your people 1, 2, 3. So my only problem was, look, since when are we dictating to the people? You know, let's go and find out what the people think.
Mm.
Now we find that Ecoli 2002 ignores all those processes and actually comes with plans which are hashed, you know, by small committees, primarily World Bank, under World Bank advice, under the advice of private companies like Deloitte and Touche, like Price Waterhouse. So this is the situation.
Mm.
And, you know, when I question that, the ANC region, Johannesburg region, within 3 days, I was stripped of all my positions in the ANC. They fell on me like a ton of bricks,
mm-hmm.
you know. So this is the situation. And I think when that happened to me, all councillors who maybe thought they might raise a small voice of caution, you know, of protest, they were all silenced, you know, they were frightened, yeah.
Mm. So you were the example.
In a way, yeah, mm. yeah.
Free Speech Radio News correspondent Naeem Jinnah spoke with Trevor Ngawe in Johannesburg. In New York today, the commencement address for the graduating high school students of Brooklyn Friends School was delivered by death row inmate and former Black Panther Mumia Abu-Jamal. Abu-Jamal has been the invited speaker at several college graduation ceremonies, but this was the first time he'd been approached by high school students. And though the school has a progressive reputation, including the speech in the program was not without controversy. Free Speech Radio's Nadja Middleton reports.
What can an old geek like me tell young folks like you, kids sitting with robes on, dying to get out of here?
To the majority of the seniors of Brooklyn Friends School, who voted to include Mumia Abu-Jamal's address at their high school graduation ceremony, the convicted journalist is no geek. As far as they are concerned, Mumia has spent a lifetime on death row. Through his unrelenting social activism and his ongoing struggle to get a fair trial, they see a man who, in the face of oppression, continues to stand up for what he believes in and maintains his faith in humanity. Rebecca Ragunath and Javier Gaston Greenberg are two seniors from Brooklyn Friends School.
This man symbolizes what our school tries to instill in us, and that is to seek the truth in whatever we do, whether it be the truth, the scientific, philosophical, it's to seek the truth.
He's really a hero for our generation. He's been a voice of the voiceless, and he's kind of an example of abuse of Latinos and Blacks.
I have
always been interested in him. I've always really wanted to meet him and, like, have a conversation.
C.C. Ross played a crucial role in making this address possible. Returning home from a graduation advisory meeting with her class, where many said, "Wouldn't it be cool if we could have Mumia?" C.C. talked with her mother, a veteran campaigner for Abu Jamal.
She wrote him a letter, and the second he heard about it, I mean, I think he started recording it. He didn't wait for us to tell him, you know, that what we wanted him to speak about or anything. He was just really excited, and we didn't know if our administration would let us, like, do this and everything, and he just did it anyway and sent it to us.
Following the class's vote, Ross submitted a transcript of Abu Jamal's address to the school administration. Since Abu Jamal is accused of murder, and given the backdrop of previous controversies and confrontations surrounding his commencement addresses, such as those that occurred at Antioch College in May this year, the administration of the Quaker School was reluctant. It questioned the appropriateness of the student's choice. According to Kevin Myilke, a teacher at Brooklyn Friends School and an advisor to the senior class, the administration avoided discussing more fundamental issues and sought to ban the playing of Abu Jamal's speech on the basis of technicalities.
Michael Nell, the head of the school, came and met with the senior class and presented a text copy of the speech to the seniors. The seniors hadn't heard the speech, they hadn't read the speech. They had previously agreed to have Mumia write a speech, record it, and have it played at graduation. And that decision was made many weeks ago. And he basically said that there were some concerns, that there were some parents and some teachers that were uncomfortable with having the speech played. He said that ultimately, if the senior class still wanted the speech to be played, that he would agree to have it played as long as the school's board also approved it.
But approvals and consensus weren't the only issues. The school administration also had concerns about the content of the graduation address.
A lot of us know that the early Quakers were leading abolitionists who worked against slavery, right? Well, that's true, but it wasn't always so. George Fox, the founder of the Quakers, owned slaves. So does his famous disciple, a man named William Penn, who was the founder of the Pennsylvania colony. Over a century later, as late as the 1730s, one of the leading slave dealers in Pennsylvania, called the Quaker State, was a Quaker named Isaac Morris.
After some research and much hesitation, the administration finally conceded. In his address, Abu Jamal doesn't just give a history lesson. He explains the value of history and celebrates the present and future achievements of the young graduates.
Who we define ourselves as, how we speak, how we see the world, how we dress even, is a function of our history. None of us can escape history. History isn't just a boring excursion into dry, hoary piles of books filled with a mind-numbing explosion of dates, names, and facts. History, true history, teaches us more about today than yesterday. History, done well, can be utterly fascinating.
One speech might not change the world, but I do think that it's a step, and I think that just by having young people, high school students, getting ready to go to college, interested in matters like these, wanting Mumia at our graduation, I think that's a really big step into the future. And I just hope that one day we can live in a world of equality and peace.
Your youthfulness is the one thing that will carry you through. For to be young is to have hope, and nothing is ever possible without hope. Don't let the adult world beat that out of you, for that is one of your more glorious features. We live in a world where social movements have shaped consciousness. How could this have been possible without hope? You all, in your hearts, in your souls, have something truly precious in your midst, hope. With this alone, you can begin to transform history and the world we live in. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
For Free Speech Radio, I'm Nadja Middleton.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. Over 40 freelance reporters in 14 states and on 4 continents are boycotting the Pacifica Network News for censoring legitimate news stories. These reporters are risking their livelihoods. To find out more, check out our webpage at www.savepacifica.net/strike. I'm Matt Martin. Please tune in again next week.